I want you to try a little experiment with me. And it's a terrifying one, so stay with me here.
Okay, I'm ready.
Imagine walking into your bathroom, turning on the light, and looking into the mirror. You see a face staring back at you, but you have absolutely no idea who that person is.
Man.
You don't know your name, you don't know your parents, you don't know where you live. Your mind is just, it's a complete blank slate.
That is, well, I mean, that's the literal definition of an existential crisis. Just
Yeah.
total loss of self.
Right, but it gets worse because while you're staring at the stranger in the mirror, someone tells you one single horrific fact about your life.
Oh, no.
They tell you that 3 days ago you killed a man.
Okay, yeah, now you've moved from an existential crisis to a complete legal nightmare.
Exactly. And the thing is, this isn't a hypothetical. This isn't the plot of a new Netflix thriller or something. This actually
It
happened.
really did.
Today, we are doing a deep dive into a fascinating case study by a therapist named Clint Matheny. It's titled A Case of Dissociative Amnesia. And we're also pulling from his broader body of work on emotional health, his therapist's toolbox.
Right.
But honestly, this case study reads like a courtroom thriller where the detective isn't a cop, it's a
In a
therapist.
very specific kind of therapist. What's so impactful about this particular deep dive is that we're looking at a source that bridges the gap between mental health and the legal system.
Yeah.
Matheny isn't just talking about feelings here. He's using a very specific set of linguistic tools from that toolbox to solve a puzzle that the police just couldn't crack.
And the stakes really could not be higher. We are talking about a young man facing prison time,
Yeah.
a father desperate to save him, and a therapist who has basically one shot to unlock a mind that has completely shut down. So let's unpack this.
Let's do it. But we do need to be clear about the starting point here, because this isn't just everyday forgetfulness.
Yeah, definitely not. So the story begins in the 1990s. Matthew gets a phone call from a coworker, and this guy is panic-stricken. He's the father of a 20-year-old son.
Right.
And he tells Matheny, "My son was in a fatal accident 3 days ago, and he hasn't slept since."
Which, to be fair, if you've just been in a fatal crash, insomnia seems like a pretty standard reaction. It's an acute stress response.
True, but this was different. The father explains that the son is just gone, not physically, but mentally. He doesn't know who he is. The father says the son literally does not recognize himself in the mirror.
Yeah, and this is what clinicians refer to as retrograde dissociative amnesia, or sometimes psychogenic amnesia.
Okay.
And it's incredibly rare to see at this total. Usually people forget it's a specific traumatic event like the crash itself, but to forget your entire identity, your name, your face,
Yeah.
that is the mind essentially pulling the emergency brake on the whole system.
Throwing the emergency brake. I like that analogy.
Think of it like a circuit breaker in your house. If there is a massive power surge that threatens to burn down the whole house, the breaker trips, the lights go out, everything shuts down.
Right, to save the house.
Exactly. In this case, the reality of what happened, or what the son thinks happened, was so unbearable, so emotionally hot, that his brain just cut the connection to his identity to protect him.
And the reality he was escaping was pretty grim. The son was driving a truck. There was an accident. A man died on the side of the highway.
Yeah.
The police found the son's driver's license, called the father, and now the district attorney is charging this 20-year-old kid with negligent homicide.
So you have a young man who has no memory of the crime, no memory of himself. And he's being told he's a killer.
Yeah.
You can really see why the dissociation held so firm.
Because if he remembers, he has to accept the guilt.
Right. The brain is basically saying, if being me means being a murderer, I'd rather be nobody.
Wow. So the father's desperate. He wants an appointment that day. Matheny agrees, but he does something very interesting right off the bat. He asks the father, "Can I videotape the session?"
Which is a wildly high-risk move.
You think so? I mean, I thought it was smart capturing the evidence.
It's smart if the kid is innocent. But think about the legal implications here. Matheny is about to induce a trance-like state to recover memories.
Oh, I see.
What happens if the kid remembers looking at a map, or falling asleep at the wheel, or texting if this were today?
Then you've just recorded a full confession.
Exactly. You have handed the district attorney a perfectly recorded confession of negligent homicide. Matheny was gambling here.
Yeah, she must have been.
He likely suspected that the amnesia was hiding something inconsistent with the charges, but he couldn't have known for sure.
That adds a whole layer of tension I hadn't even considered.
Yeah.
So the father and son arrive. The father leaves them alone. Matheny walks the kid to the office restroom and stands him in front of the mirror.
Right.
And again, the kid looks at his reflection and nothing, no recognition at all.
It's heartbreaking. But it establishes the baseline. The file for his identity is corrupted. It won't open.
So Masani starts digging. He asks what the son can remember. And it turns out there's only one fragment, one tiny horrific scene stuck in his head.
The anchor point.
Yeah. He remembers a police officer pointing at a dead body and the victim's friend screaming at him, "You killed my friend."
That's the trauma imprint right there. That voice, that accusation. That's likely the exact moment the circuit breaker tripped.
It was just too much to process.
Exactly. His brain couldn't process the horror of that statement, so it shut down.
So how do you get past that? This is where we get into the therapist's toolbox you mentioned earlier. Matheny uses a technique called clean language.
Yes.
Now, to me, clean language sounds like, you know, polite conversation, like not swearing. But I assume that's not what this is.
No, not quite. No, although, given the situation, swearing might be justified.
Fair point.
No. Clean language is a therapeutic method developed by David Grove in the 80s. It's called clean because it keeps the therapist's dirt, their own assumptions, metaphors, and interpretations entirely out of the client's way.
Contaminating it how? Like, give me an example of dirty language in therapy.
Okay, imagine if Matheny had said, "You must have felt very scared when the accident happened."
That seems like a normal, empathetic question to ask.
It is socially. But forensically, it's terrible. It's a leading question.
Oh.
It plants the idea of fear in the client's mind. Maybe he wasn't scared. Maybe he was angry. Maybe he was totally numb. If the therapist introduces the word scared, the client might just agree to be polite.
And in a legal case, that could get the testimony thrown out.
Precisely. You're leading the witness. You're tampering with the evidence inside their head.
The mind is the crime scene.
That is exactly it. You cannot touch anything. So clean language uses a very strict, almost robotic syntax. You use the client's exact words and you ask recursive questions. The structure is almost always, "And what happens before X?"
Why before? Yeah. Why not ask why? Like, why did that happen?
Because why invites a story. If I ask, "Why did you do that?" you might say, "Because I was late." That's a narrative.
Right.
And narratives are often made up or justified after the fact. What happens before is a request for a sequence. It forces the brain to access the actual timeline, not the emotional excuse.
Okay, let's walk through the actual dialogue from the session because the rhythm of it is fascinating. It's almost hypnotic.
It really is.
Matheny starts with that one memory, the screaming friend.
Right. So Matheny asks, "And what happened before a screaming man?"
And the son says, "I see the bloody body."
Matheny doesn't react. He doesn't say, "Oh, how awful." He just keeps the loop going. "And what happens before a bloody body?"
The son says, "Black."
Now pause right there.
Yeah.
Because most people, most therapists even, would stop at black. They'd assume that's the blackout, that's the crash, that's the trauma wall.
Right, you assume that's the end of the line. But Matheny pushes on the wall. He asks, "And what happens before black?"
He treats black as just another event in the chain, not the end of the chain.
And the son answers, "I'm passing out."
This is the critical shift.
Yeah.
We just moved from a visual memory seeing black to a somatic memory, a body memory. "I am passing out."
We are moving backward in time, millisecond by millisecond. Matheny asks again, "What happens before passing out?"
And this is where the scene changes completely.
The son says it's hot. I'm driving the truck.
And Matheny presses one more time, digging for the absolute root cause. "And what happens next when it is hot and you are driving the truck?"
The son says, "My head is pounding," and it goes black.
Boom. There it is.
Okay, let's unpack this because the details here literally change everything. The son remembered his head was pounding and it was hot.
Not just hot. The recovered memory revealed the physical reality of that day. It was 101 degrees Fahrenheit with incredibly high humidity.
And the vehicle.
He was driving a panel delivery truck.
And for anyone who hasn't been in one of those, they are basically ovens on wheels.
Yeah. Exactly. Uninsulated steel. And crucially, Matheny notes, it had no air conditioning. If it's 101 outside, it could easily be 130 degrees inside that cab.
So the sequence of events isn't driver falls asleep and kills someone. It isn't driver looks at phone and kills someone.
No. The sequence is excessive heat, physiological distress, head pounding, heat exhaustion, passing out, then the crash.
That is a massive distinction.
It changes everything. It changes it from a criminal act of negligence to a medical emergency. He passed out before the accident even occurred.
Wow.
He wasn't conscious when the truck hit the victim. He had succumbed to heat stroke.
It's incredible that a simple question and what happens before could unearth that detail. The brain had just buried it under the trauma of the screaming man.
That's the power of the clean language approach. By stripping away the story and just looking for the raw sequence of events, the biological truth came out. The pounding, the heat, those are physical sensations that were stored in the body's memory, even if the conscious mind had entirely deleted the narrative.
So they have this breakthrough. The son realizes, wait, I didn't kill him out of negligence. I passed out from the heat. What actually happens in the room at that point?
Matheny does a very gentle check-in. He lists back the chain of events before the blackout, before the pounding head, before the heat, and asks, is it okay to come back to here and now feeling the weight of your body in the chair?
Grounding him and the sun.
He says, I'm okay.
And then comes the movie moment. Matheny walks him back to that restroom mirror.
And this time he recognizes the face staring back. He knows his name. The circuit breaker has been reset. The identity is back online.
That honestly gives me chills. And we have to mention the timeline here. This wasn't 6 months of intensive psychoanalysis.
No. The source notes that the entire session lasted less than an hour. 35 minutes of precise questioning to completely undo total amnesia.
And what happened with the legal cases where that videotape gamble comes in, right?
Right. The father took that videotape, the one Matheny insisted on making, and showed it directly to the assistant district attorney.
A super bold move. If the DA thought it looked fake or if it showed any hint of guilt, it would have completely backfired.
But it worked. The video showed genuine memory recovery. It showed the medical distress as he relived the heat stroke. It wasn't some rehearsed alibi. Because of that tape, the charges were dropped. The DA recognized it was a medical tragedy, not a homicide.
It saved his life, essentially, or at least saved him from a life behind bars.
Without a doubt. If they had gone to court without that memory, the physical evidence just looked like a guy who ran off the road. The heat stroke defense would have sounded like a desperate excuse, but the tape showed the visceral recovery of the truth.
Now, I want to zoom out a bit, because while this story is amazing, it's part of a larger picture of how Matheny works. We talked about his therapist's toolbox, and looking through his other writings, he talks about things like memory reconsolidation.
Yes.
That sounds pretty technical. Can we break that down?
Sure. Think of a memory like a Word document on your computer. Most people think memory is like a read-only PDF. It happened, it's saved, it's permanent. But actually, every time you open a memory, every time you remember it, it becomes editable. It becomes unstable.
So every time I think about my childhood, I'm potentially changing it.
Exactly. In traditional therapy, you might open the trauma document, read it, feel sad, and then close it again.
Yeah.
You haven't changed the file. You just felt the pain again. That's just coping.
But Matheny is talking about actually rewriting the file.
He's talking about resolving it. Reconsolidation means you unlock the synapses holding that memory. You introduce new contradictory information, and then you resave the file without the emotional charge.
In this case, the new information was the heat.
Exactly. The old file said, I am a murderer. I killed a man. That's a file the brain couldn't handle, so it hit it. The new information, the pounding head, the heat, contradicted that entirely. It said I had heat stroke. It was an accident.
And once the brain accepts that new truth,
it overwrites the old file. The guilt evaporates because it's no longer logical. You can't be guilty of a medical emergency. That's why the amnesia could lift. The brain didn't need to hide from the truth anymore because the truth wasn't, I'm a killer. The truth was, I was sick.
So the circuit breaker didn't need to be tripped anymore.
Exactly. The threat was gone.
It's fascinating that Matheny lists things like clean language alongside things like eye movement integration or the flash technique. It seems like he treats the brain less like a mysterious soul cloud and more like computer code that can be debugged.
That's a really fair analogy.
Hmm.
And looking at his broader body of work, there is a strong critique of the endless therapy model. He lists successes with PTSD, phobias, depression, often resolved in very short time frames using these targeted techniques.
Yeah.
It challenges the assumption that healing must be a long, painful slog. Sometimes if you find the right lever, the door just swings open.
Like finding the right key for a lock.
Or the right line of code. In this deep dive, the key was a specific grammatical loop. And what happens before?
Matheny mentions in the source material that he did a follow-up a week later and remarkably another follow-up recently in 2025.
That's over 30 years later.
And what happened?
The fix held. The son, now a much older man, stayed cured. He didn't relapse into amnesia. This suggests that the session didn't just put a Band-Aid on the problem. It genuinely processed the trauma via that reconsolidation we talked about.
It really highlights the connection between our biology, the heat, the passing out, and our psychology. We tend to think of them as separate things, like I'm sad versus I have a fever. But here, the fever literally caused the psychological collapse.
Absolutely. The body keeps the score. The son's conscious mind checked out, but his body remembered the heat pounding in his head. Matheny just provided the language code to access that file.
You know, it makes you wonder how many other people are sitting in prisons or suffering in hospitals simply because no one asked the right question.
It is a sobering thought. We rely so heavily on what people say happened on their conscious narrative. But we forget that the brain is an unreliable narrator, especially under stress. It deletes things. It edits things.
The brain is trying to protect us, but sometimes its protection is the exact problem.
The ultimate glitch. The brain deletes the file to save the operating system. But in this case, you desperately needed that file to prove your innocence.
Well, this has been a mind-bending look into the mechanics of memory. We started with a man looking in a mirror, seeing a stranger, and we ended with a man exonerated by the temperature of a summer day.
It's a powerful reminder of how complex and yet how logical our minds really are.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with a thought. We talked about how this young man's brain deleted his entire identity to protect him from a horrific reality. That's an extreme example, but it makes you wonder about the everyday.
What do you mean?
If the brain is capable of that, of erasing a murderer name, a life to keep us sane, what minor edits is it making right now? What conversations, what embarrassing moments, what uncomfortable truths are you editing out of your memory today just to get through the week?
That is really unsettling. If you stopped and really asked yourself, and what happened just before that, what might you find lurking in the background that you've conveniently forgotten?
Scary thought, but maybe a necessary one to really know ourselves. Stay curious, everyone.
Keep asking questions.